Welcome to the House Committee on Environment and Water. Call this committee to order, and we're going to open up from the bottom of the agenda, actually, with a work session on House Bill 3463. This is a bill committee that we heard a couple of weeks ago, and Representative Bailey and Representative Jensen, at the conclusion of that hearing, agreed to spend some time with the stakeholders to figure out how we might be able to move this bill forward, and they have prepared a set of amendments which should be in your packet, and I'll ask Representative Bailey and perhaps Representative Jensen if he returns to describe those amendments to us. My understanding, committee, is that they will need there's a slight change still to be made, so we're not I'm not going to be asking for a motion on 3463 today, but wanted to bring the committee's attention to the work that had been done. I think this is the direction that we will plan to head, and this should expedite our work session next week. So, Representative Bailey, can you tell us what you have done to 3463?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, colleagues, Representative Jensen and I had a chance to meet several times with folks on various sides of this issue to come to an area where I think we can have a policy that's workable. The Dash 1 amendment is fairly complicated in its layout, but really achieves two simple things. The first is that it changes the effective date in 3463. The way 3463 is currently written, it says that it changes the 3-month notification to a 2-month notification for when capacity is reached at a biodiesel production facility for to trigger the renewable fuel standard. What the change does in the timeline is, instead of having a 2-month trigger, it sets specific dates of August 1st for Willamette Valley counties and October 1st for the rest of Oregon. And there was broad agreement on those dates. The second thing that the amendment does is relates to the renewable diesel that is deleted in the original bill. And rather than deleting renewable diesel as it is in the original bill, the amendment creates a 2-year moratorium on renewable diesel, and that is the reason for the length of the amendment, is that there are essentially two sections of statute in the amendment that are identical, one with renewable diesel and one without renewable diesel. The one without renewable diesel takes effect immediately on passage. The one with renewable diesel does not take effect until 2 years from this date. So that explains the length of the amendment. There's one minor technical change, just making sure that the effective dates really are the effective dates and dealing with some language that needs to be deleted from the original bill, as well as some a couple of issues related to B5 capacity, but they should be minor and easy. Representative Jensen, I appreciate all your hard work on this. Did you want to add anything?
No, I think you've covered that.
Any questions for Representative Bailey? All right. Well, members, I believe this will be posted for a week from today, next Thursday, and we'll expect to move the bill along then. So take a look at the amendments and come with questions for Representatives Bailey or Jensen then, and I'm sure they don't mind getting them in advance if you have questions or concerns. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3463, and we will open a work session on 2859. This is a water bill. We have also heard previously. And members, you should have Dash 2 amendments in front of you. And again, with this bill, it is not my intention to move today, but did want to give the committee and the department the opportunity to speak to this bill, hoping to expedite our limited time next week when we'll come back into work session on this. So I will look for my Dash 2s. Brenda, could you come forward, and I realize this is not your bill.
Yeah.
sure we get the opportunity to ask any questions. And could you describe, as you understand the Dash 2 amendments, what this bill would do with the Dash 2s? That would be great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to make a few comments on House Bill 2859. So I am working off the Dash 2 amendment, and this amendment introduces three concepts that were not in the original bill that are very important. And one is first requiring a map by tax lot, so that would be additional detailed information that the department currently does not receive with regard to these exempt use wells. The second would be authorizing our Water Resources Commission to require a permit on exempt use wells if they are within designated areas, administrative areas such as critical groundwater areas, groundwater limited areas. These are places where groundwater has already been identified as having scarcity. And the third new piece would be to charge a one-time recording fee of $250 for these wells. So these are concepts that we very much appreciate and have been in dialogue and discussion about these concepts for years with stakeholders. You may recall from our testimony in the previous session that we were part of a work group during this past year in 2008. Grappling with some of these issues, and all of these ideas came up, and generally, very broadly, the idea of more data, more information with regard to groundwater, and more funding in this area were broadly supported by folks. We didn't get into the detail, the actual dollar figures and things that are in here, so I couldn't speak to the level of support, but generally, data and funding in these areas were very much well regarded by stakeholders. One thing that I wanted to point out about this bill that does concern us is the relating clause and terminology that's carried throughout the bill that's different than what we have in statute and may potentially pose some problems for us in implementation. And that is a focus on the term domestic well versus exempt use well, which I think may have been where the drafters were actually going, given the rest of the language that's in throughout this bill. And just to lay out in layman's terms, for us, an exempt use well, it's more specifically defined in statute, but this is a well that does not require a permit up front, and there are about half a dozen different categories that trigger your eligibility to be an exempt use well, including lawn and garden irrigation, less than 1/2 acre in size, stock watering, industrial and commercial use, less than 5,000 gallons, and also domestic use. So for us, this is talking about indoor household type of use. Domestic use is but one of several exempt types of uses, and because the bill interchanges this terminology, it would be very difficult for us to implement the bill in its current stage and sort of tease out that one thread that refers just to domestic use, when in fact there are several kinds of exempt uses now, and that's how we keep our records, and that's how we manage the water, and that's how we actually enforce the rules. So that is a primary concern for us. But generally, with the concepts that are introduced here, we very much like the direction that the bill is going.
Members, with the Dash 2 amendments that include a new fee, we would take a motion, not today, but when we come back to this bill, take a motion to move this to Ways and Means with the Speaker's approval. That wasn't on the original bill, since the original bill didn't have the funding source, but we would not be in a position to move this to the floor. We would need to make sure this gets reviewed by Budgeting Committee of the House. Are there any questions or comments? Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. I'm having a little difficulty understanding the comments that were just made. I'm looking at ORS 537.545, which is Section 1 of the bill, with an ad, of course, at the end of it, in which the current language already includes the term single or group domestic purposes in an amount not exceeding 15,000 gallons a day. And then at the end of that statute, still in Section 1, we're adding, if groundwater is for domestic purposes, it's described in subsection 1D of this section, which is the part I just read, then these other things, all the rest of the black letter on page 3, apply. I'm having trouble understanding what the difficulty is, since the the thing that we're talking about is already clearly defined in statute. It is one of the exempt uses. Apparently, this bill addresses only one of the exempt uses. It doesn't address stock watering, watering lawns, deep hole heat exchange, single industry or commercial development, or land application. It only addresses domestic purposes, as in 1B. So I'm having a hard time understanding what the witness was describing as the concern or the problem.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and maybe you can speak to it again. I think it's more of an administrative challenge than a legal one, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I may have left out one key piece of information, which is that oftentimes these exempt-use wells host more than one use. So you'll have a domestic use, but also the others within the same well. And so with this bill really speaking to but one of those uses, applying a fee, requiring a permit, and placing other conditions, that will be confusing, and it may, I could see where that would run into some enforcement or logistic difficulties in teasing apart just that one piece.
Does that answer your question?
Well, I think it does. Let me, if I may, ask a different way. So let's suppose that there's a well which is being used for domestic purposes. It's also used for watering lawns. Then I would assume that if this went into effect, that well that was affected by this would have to go through the process described on the third page in order to use it for domestic purposes, but would not have to go through the process to use the water for watering lawns.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's correct. And if the two uses were co-located in the same well, it would be these conditions would be triggered because of the domestic use portion of it.
Right. So the
yes.
So without a permit, you could do the watering lawns, but you couldn't do the domestic purposes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The remarks that are made by former director of the department, Martha Pagel, are attached in our packet, and I join her in her thoughts on what is found in paragraph B on page 3 of the dash twos, and that is that this device, this restriction, is already captured in 537.735. So, in a sense, we're being duplicative with this proposal. So I'm just wondering, former Director Pagel suggests that the appropriate approach would be to amend 537.735 as opposed to utilizing the approach reflected in paragraph B on page 3 of the dash 2s. Of course, the reason it makes a difference is there's no particular reason to include a prohibition or a requirement that, one apply for a water right where there's been a designation of a critical groundwater area or an order of withdrawal. It actually creates confusion, I think, because I believe under one of them, when you withdraw it, I don't think you can apply for a water right. That's my recollection. So here we're basically saying you can't, but I don't think you can anyway under that one because of the other statute. So I'm just wondering if we don't need to do some more work just to avoid that kind of confusion. So that's my thought.
Thank you for your comment. Do you want to respond to that, Brenda, or take note and come back next week? Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Representative Boone.
Yeah, and I'm just seeing this for the first time, too, and respect Martha Pagel's experience in this area and would like to take a little more time to review this in terms of what she's in lieu of what she's saying and adopting this amendment right now.
Thank you, Representative Boone. And go ahead.
May I add some detail? Mr. Chair, Representatives, the tools that we have in place today, just to clarify, is that we can always go in and regulate a well. If there's a complaint of interference or a problem, we can certainly go and look at that. That's largely after the fact, however. What paragraph B, I believe, is trying to get to is an ability to look at exempt use wells before they go in, perhaps save the landowner some money if we are able to do initial review and look at water availability, look at the other wells and aquifers in the area, and make a determination that, in fact, this wouldn't be a good way to move forward. So getting information to a landowner before a well is drilled is part of what this paragraph B is getting to, I think. We can't do that today. We have much more blunt instruments, and we can either not provide permits or we can go in afterwards and regulate if there's a complaint lodged. So,
yeah, I think that as I've understood this, the sort of challenge that we have and the situation we're trying to prevent is the situation where somebody drills a well in one of these areas, and then the department, using the authority that they do have, later comes along and says, actually, the water's not available. You're jeopardizing more senior water rights holders, and then shuts that well down. And that's the tool, sort of broadly, that the mm-hmm. department has now. The intent here is to provide, in these critical limited groundwater areas, provide the department with the ability to say to a prospective well driller, actually, we've done the analysis, the water is not available, and therefore we're not going to issue a permit. Is that?
Yes, sir, or we could issue a permit with specific conditions,
right,
because of the the surrounding conditions.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question from our last hearing on this, and I'm not sure if it connects now that you have three new concepts. So my question is, how do we measure the water use on an exempt well? I guess I don't understand that.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, when our water master has a question from a landowner or a neighbor or a complaint of interference, they can go and actually put a meter on a well if there isn't one already, or look at the one that's there if it is, and gauge the amount of water that's being used and also the water levels that are in the well. And there are scientists, there are hydrologists or hydrogeologists, and are able to take the scientific data from that well and the surrounding areas and figure out what's going
on. So if there's a problem or a situation arises, it's a spot check, so to speak. It's not, that's how you go and check it over a period of time.
That's right. That's one important tool.
Thank you.
Great. Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to carry over. First note for the record, a letter from Tom Bowman, Scott Miller, and Pat Larson, Union County Cattlemen, President, Vice President, and Secretary, respectively. We've heard about the letter from, or the email from, Martha Pagel, and that's it for the record today. We'll carry this over, and I will close the work session on
Tuesday.
Carry over until Tuesday, and close the work session on House Bill 2859. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2186, and we have the list of guests. I'm going to start with Andy Ginsberg from DEQ to talk about the process that got us to the, are they the dash ones? The dash twos?
Four.
Dash fours. The dash four amendments on 2186.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. And I'm here, as you said, to describe the changes in the Dash 4 amendments and also the public process that got us here. First, I just want to briefly review what this bill is about, since it's been a while since we talked about it. The bill would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt targeted measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuel vehicles and greenhouse gas-containing products. And it's important to note that it's an authorization, not a mandate, and there are no deadlines for this to be done, but it is authority for the Commission to move forward with these strategies. And there are a number of strategies that are specifically authorized in the bill. It would include authority to lower the full life cycle carbon emissions from transportation fuels by setting a low carbon fuel standard. It would authorize us to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from trucks by reducing idling and retrofitting them to reduce air and road drag. It would also authorize us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from cars by ensuring that car service providers inflate tires when they're otherwise servicing a vehicle, to ensure that Oregon gets the best performing tires as technology improves, and also to prevent tampering with key emission-related vehicle parts. And finally, unrelated to transportation, it would also allow us to require manufacturers to reformulate products that contain high-potency greenhouse gases if there are safe and cost-effective commercially available substitutes that are available. So first, I'd like to just describe the public process since we had our initial hearings on February 3rd and February 10th. And I'll summarize for you the concerns that were raised at the hearing and also subsequently with us, and just let you know what we've been doing for the last 2 months to try and address the concerns. Immediately after the hearing, we developed a stakeholder list of everyone that was interested in this bill. The list is now over 60 stakeholders, and there are many organizations that are represented. We held, initially right after the hearings, we held a number of conference calls with subsets of these stakeholders to talk about specific parts of the bill that they were most interested in. So, for example, with the low carbon fuel standard, we talked with the oil industry, with the alternate fuels industry, and the environmental community, and so forth, with all the sections of the bill. And the purpose of those conversations was to make sure we really understood what their concerns were so that we could draft some amendments. Then we began, with the assistance of the Department of Justice, drafting amendments to address those concerns, circulated them first to the small group and then to the full group, and we held actually two meetings of the full group and with this over 60 stakeholders, many of them in person, those that couldn't be there in person, including ones from national organizations in Washington, D.C., were on conference call, and those were held on March 9th and March 20th. And we went through all of the changes in the bill. After the first large group meeting, we did another round of amendments, circulated to the full group, had a second large group meeting, and then we did a final round of amendments. So there's been a lot of public scrutiny and review of these amendments. And I would just like to thank on the record briefly all of those people for all that time invested in helping us to improve the legislation. So the result is the Dash 4 amendments. And they are intended to address the specific concerns that were raised through all those conversations. And many stakeholders now who had initially had concerns about the bill now find the bill acceptable. And I'd like to just call your attention. You should have in your packet two letters, one from the Special Equipment Manufacturers Association, or SEMA, and another from the Rubber Manufacturers Association. They represent auto parts suppliers and also tire manufacturers. They had grave concerns with the initial bill as it was introduced. That resulted in membership alerts going out to their members and a lot of contact with you and your staff. And those letters now, both of them, have withdrawn their objections to the legislation if the Dash 4 amendments are incorporated into the legislation. Having said that, though, there are many other stakeholders, and I'm sure many in the audience today, that still have concerns about this legislation, and I don't want to give you the impression that everyone is satisfied with the amendments. And I'm sure that you'll hear from them today, but I will summarize as I go through the key concerns that I think still exist. And before I get into the specifics, I just want to start with a couple of the general concerns that were raised. And the first has to do with the level of delegation from the legislature to the Environmental Quality Commission. And the concern raised was that the delegation was too broad. And what we've done about that is to significantly narrow the delegation by including amendments that put many specific sidebars on the commission's authority. The original bill was 35 lines long, and the bill is now 173 lines long, just to give you a sense of how we've added a lot of detail. So the distinction now is that the policy choices, if you choose to adopt this legislation, will be made by the legislature. The technical details would be made by the commission, and our judgment is that any more detail in the bill would actually be detrimental because technology is going to advance, and if we lock ourselves into where we are now, it'll be too much detail.
Representative,
I have a question, yeah, if I might, at this point. Andy, do you think it would be, considering what you just said and the level of involvement of all these people, and in the spirit of giving us a little more settlement in our minds about this, and to just keep people updated, do you agree to an interim update to this committee, should we continue as an interim committee, and then following up with a report to the next legislature with what's happened, another update, what's happening in other states, how things are going, are things working like we are told they're going to work, and if things are, it's kind of a long sentence, I know, if things are changing in the sector and in the in technology that's available now, or changing, et cetera, and people's experiences as they come online with things on their own of their own accord.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, I think that's an excellent suggestion, it certainly would be our intent to keep the legislature informed, and if you would like, we could draft an amendment that would require us to come back to the interim committee as well as to the next legislature with reports on our progress in implementing this legislation.
I would, personally, I can't speak for the rest of the committee, but I would like that. We're doing this in a lot of other areas, in committees and on bills on which I'm working. Our Coastal Caucus is doing it in the area of marine reserves. We're doing it in a lot of different areas where there's been a lot of concerns by people out in the communities and wondering what, because things change really fast sometimes. So it would give me a level of calmness, I think, to know that this is going to happen. And being part of the process in that sense, and I've had it happen where I wanted that to happen and it didn't, and I felt totally left out of the process. And I think this is a case where we want to be involved in it as much as we can.
Representative Boone, I really appreciate your comments and think it's absolutely critical that we ensure that we maintain proper oversight of this process. And I think this notion that DEQ would be required to come back and report on the implementation of this bill is a very good one. Go ahead, Amy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second general concern that was noted was that basically a question of why did we pick these particular strategies and what would happen if some other agency was working on a smarter strategy that affected the same sector. And so my response to that is that the strategies that are in this legislation are on the short list of many states that have gone through scoping exercises for early actions that can be taken to make progress on greenhouse gases. And the reason for that is they provide significant co-benefits. That is, they either save energy or they also reduce other types of air pollution, toxic air emissions, and some of them actually can even help with economic development. So these are the so-called low-hanging fruit, those things that make sense to go forward with on an early basis. And our neighbors to the south have already adopted many of these, and the ones they haven't adopted, they're working on. Our neighbors to the north have most of them on their short list, and you'll also find throughout the country many of the states that are doing scoping exercises on greenhouse gas measures have these very measures on their lists. I would like to point you to on page 6 of the Dash 4 in section 4 on line 26, a specific provision that we put in to address this concern. And this provision requires us to look at the benefits of and costs of any rules that we might adopt under this legislation in relation to programs that other state agencies have either adopted or are considering adopting, even if they haven't proposed rules yet, but they're working on them, to make sure that what we're doing has a better cost benefit than what they're doing. And so if we find that, and since most of this bill deals with transportation, let's just say particularly if the Department of Energy or Transportation or DLCD or another agency is working on a measure that's makes more sense from a cost effectiveness standpoint than what we have under this bill, we will hold off until ours becomes the next most cost effective thing to do. So that was put in specifically to try and encourage this interagency coordination. So now turning to specifically to the specific measures in the bill, as I said, most of the bill deals with transportation emissions, so I'd like to cover those first, even though it'll be slightly out of order for the way the bill's structured. There are three primary ways we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. One is to lower the greenhouse gas content of the fuel that is burned. Another is to improve the efficiency of vehicles so they burn less fuel. And a third is to reduce the number of hours that engines are actually running. And this bill has measures that address all three of those. So I'd like to start with the carbon content of fuel, and if I could call your attention to Section 3.2, which starts on page 2, on line 25. So this is the low carbon fuel standard. Its purpose is to reduce the carbon content of the life cycle carbon emissions from gasoline and diesel fuel. At the hearings and also in subsequent discussions, the concerns that were expressed about this, first from the petroleum industry, there were questions about fuel supply and the cost of fuel. From the propane and natural gas industries, there were questions about the impacts on those fuels, which are low carbon fuels, and a question about what their responsibilities would be, if any, under this bill. The truckers had questions about the quality of biodiesel that might be blended under this low carbon fuel standard to make sure that the biodiesel met manufacturer specs and didn't void their warranties if used in their trucks. And then a number of electric vehicle operators wanted to be ensured that there was recognition for electricity as a low carbon fuel in the bill. So starting on page 2 on line 25, we clarified that the low carbon fuel standard applies to gasoline and diesel fuel. This was at the request of the propane and natural gas representatives to make it clear that it's gasoline and diesel fuel and alternates that are used for those fuels that are actually the point of regulation in this standard. On line 29, we added a very specific phase-in schedule to go to achieve a 10% reduction in the carbon content of fuel by the year 2020. And that is the schedule that's being used by other states that are pursuing this standard, and it's designed so that it can be achieved with existing technology, so that it's not technology forcing and unlikely to result in supply shortages and price spikes. That was requested by ethanol suppliers that we add that provision. On page 3, line 2, we talk about the full life cycle. It really matters how the fuel is made. As an example, ethanol that's made from corn in the Midwest has higher carbon content than ethanol that might be made from agricultural waste products in Oregon. And so they would get a different value under this program. And you'll notice in that list that there's a specifically included land use as part of the life cycle emissions. Just to clarify, this does not restrict land use. This takes into account the greenhouse gas net impacts of changing land use. So if you had land that was currently in one agricultural use or a forestry use that was converted to growing a biofuel, that actually has a net greenhouse gas difference, and that's taken into account. And that was added at the request of the petroleum industry. But is a standard part of considering the life cycle of fuels. On line 6, we clarify that all types of low-carbon fuels may be used. There's no intent in this standard to specify the type of low-carbon fuel that may be used. It's up to the gasoline and diesel distributors to determine that. And at the hearing, the committee specifically requested that we mention electricity, and electricity is an important low-carbon fuel that is part of the low-carbon fuel standard, so it's included in the list. On line 10, we added deferrals, and the idea here is that if, in implementing this, despite our best projections, it turns out that there aren't adequate supplies of alternate fuels to meet the standard without shortages, then we would defer the compliance dates. And the important factor there is, by controlling the schedule, you avoid any significant price increases, and it's important to have that ability, even though the bill would require us to get a 10% reduction by 2020, that we can actually extend that to a longer period of time if necessary. And that was requested by the oil industry, and we also noted that we have to give adequate notice to the to the suppliers about any deferral so that no one builds a plant in anticipation of demand for their product only to find that we extended the deadline for when their product is needed. So we have to stay ahead of the curve on this at all times. Line 12, we specifically exempted propane and other low-volume fuels. Propane is not used in any significant quantities as a transportation fuel. It's used for other purposes. And so it's just not part of the program, and the commission can exempt other low-volume fuels. Line 15 requires biofuels to meet quality specifications. As I mentioned, this was requested by the Trucking Association, and that's the same language that you included in the renewable fuel standard that you adopted last session. Line 20 recognizes that electric motors are more efficient than internal combustion engines, so that you take into account not only the amount of the carbon content from the fuel itself and the carbon emissions from generating the electricity, but you get credit for the fact that more of that energy is converted into turning the wheels around with an electric motor than it would be with an internal combustion engine. And so on that basis, electricity actually is a very low carbon fuel and is greatly advantaged under this low carbon fuel standard. So just in closing on the low carbon fuel standard, you'll note that we've significantly narrowed the delegation from the commission may adopt a low carbon fuel standard to a very specific program, leaving only the technical details for the commission. There is no direct requirement for agriculture in the low carbon fuel standard. It could provide markets for agricultural products, but there's no requirement for that. But I want to note that agricultural stakeholders have informed me they still have concerns about indirect costs if the standard were to raise the price of fuel or the cost of fuel, that would play through into their costs as well. And also I'd like to note that the oil industry still would like us to delay adoption of this program until 2011. Our concern is that if you were to authorize this strategy, it will take us about 2 years to get it adopted and implemented by the time we finish our advisory committee process. The first year is a voluntary year requiring only reporting, and so it will be 3 years from when we are authorized to start rulemaking until the standards begin to phase in, and then a 10-year phase-in. So my concern about delaying until 2011 to get started is just the time lag that's involved in that. So, Mr. Chair, I could pause if there are questions on low-carbon fuel standard or keep going at your...
Sure, discretion. Let's see if there are any questions on that section of the bill. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I'm not sure if I'm tuned into this section, but I want to ask you a question. It's something that came up since we've talked. On page 3... that line 2, that section B, would there be any relationship, pardon me if I'm off base here, would there be a relationship there between what the new amendment says and motorsports and racing events because of the use of land, of possible land use? You heard from folks about
that. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, there would be no effect on that. This section is basically saying that the commission, in setting the standard, what's regulated is the carbon content, life cycle carbon content of gasoline and diesel, and they are not allowed to specify which type of alternate fuel would be used to meet that. That's completely up to the suppliers to figure that out, but it wouldn't regulate any particular event or the use of any type of fuel.
Mr. Chair, as you know, we wanted to get you in touch with every constituency in Oregon. Did you hear from anybody in that group when you were going through the amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, no, I didn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Andy, let me try to clarify in my own head the land use provision here and tell me if I'm wrong. This is, I think, designed to get at an analysis of fuel that may result, let's say, from turning a forest, is probably a carbon sink, right? Helps take carbon out of the atmosphere into farmland that may grow corn, say, that's used in fuel. And if the net effect of that, and I'm not going to try to wade in the middle of that debate, but if the net effect of that practice was to actually increase carbon emissions rather than decrease, it would be tallied as a sort of negative point on the score of that particular ethanol. Is that,
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct, and I could add that it can go even further than that. Let's say if you had farmland that was growing wheat, that was used for food production and got converted into growing corn that was used for making biofuels. Where is that wheat now grown, and what was happening on that land before? And obviously you can't look at every single farm, so there are models that are used to look at the net effect of this changes of land use, and that's included in the carbon score that each type of alternate fuel gets.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I want to say how much I appreciate your hard work on this, and it's you've really put the time in. Now, having said that, when I hear you say this is a very specific delegation of authority, I have to disagree. And the reason isn't because you didn't try hard. It's just because of the nature of the beast. It's incredibly difficult to take what you've done here and explain to us, even in any clear way, the consequences of our adopting this law. And I thought I would just focus on one thing, and maybe you could show why this is a specific delegation. If we went to, I'm going to go to line. Let's use the one where we have a shortage of fuel. Which provision is that? We suddenly realize it's not working because we don't have the right kinds of fuel.
Perhaps on line 10 on page 3?
Correct. Standards for the issuance of deferrals establish if adequate lead time is necessary to ensure adequate fuel supplies. And with all due respect to the speed at which DEQ can operate, I just wonder how rules and standards can be written that would address the dramatic fluctuations in our markets. And that would take us immediately to page 6, where we talk about flexible approaches. But all of these standards require standards and rules. And to say that this is a specific delegation, it is not. At least that's my opinion. Now, correct me if I am overstating the situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think that the judgment about whether, you know, the broadness of the delegation, I think that's everyone's personal decision to make. But I just want to address the specific question about the deferrals and how we would implement that, which is that we will, when you're looking at the capacity of biofuels, for example, and the ability for the alternate fuels industry to provide biofuels to blend as a low carbon fuel stock, that's not going to be a surprise to us. Those plants are going to be applying to DEQ for permits, or they'll be applying to our sister agencies in other states for permits. We'll know ahead of time what the plans are in terms of the production capacity in the alternate fuels market, and we'll through communication with the petroleum industry and the alternate fuels industry, we'll have a sense of whether 5 years from now that ratcheting down from we're going for 10% reduction, so 5 years from now we're going from 5% to 5.5%, whether that's going to be achievable or not. And if something really changes in the economics so that we don't see that those plants are coming online, this gives us the ability to react. And frankly, most likely where we'll hear from would be the petroleum industry letting us know that they're going to have trouble ahead of time. And so this gives us the ability to react to that.
Sure, follow up. I think I appreciate your answer. I'm just trying to suggest that just a couple of paragraphs in here require enormous amounts of work on the department's part to have any chance of this working without having incredible unanticipated consequences. And I just pick out the one I could do. We could go through the same exercise in any one of these paragraphs. Thank you.
Thank you. Go on.
Okay, so I'd like to move on now to the second of the three ways that I mentioned that transportation carbon emissions could be reduced, and that is improving the efficiency of vehicles so that they burn less fuel when they're running. And there are actually four different provisions in this bill that address this issue. And I'm going to start with truck fuel efficiency, which begins on page 4, section 3, sub 4, on lines 16 through 30. So the purpose of this provision is to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from trucks and trailers by improving their fuel efficiency. And this is one where there's a really significant co-benefit for toxic air pollutants, because if we're going to be burning less diesel fuel, we'll also get a big reduction in air toxics. Freight vehicles account for about 20% of transportation, of the energy used in transportation, so this is hitting about a fifth of the emissions in that part of the pie that's about 30 to 40% of the total impact. So this is a pretty significant piece. What we have here is that EPA on the federal level has established this program called SmartWay, and it's a package of add-ons that can be put on existing trucks and trailers that will improve their fuel economy. And the best example is you can add fairings and skirts to a truck and a trailer that will reduce the air turbulence. It causes the air to go around the truck, and it can really significantly increase the fuel economy. So the SmartWay program on the national level is voluntary, and it's had some good successes, but the voluntary program is going to get us so far, and it's not going to get us all the way. And this section would authorize us to require larger fleets of long-haul trucks, particularly long-haul trucks, to become SmartWay certified. Concerns that have been raised primarily from the truckers is the cost of the equipment. There is a capital cost on the front end to install this equipment. And we have addressed that in the amendments. I'll get into that in a moment. I also had concerns raised by agriculture about whether these provisions could affect agriculture. So going through the amendments, and again, we're on page 4, section 3.4, and I'm going to start on line 20. First, we tie ourselves into the EPA SmartWay program that wasn't clarified before, or similar programs that are run in other states. So this is an established program. On line 22, this is the key provision in this section. It requires us to ensure that financing is available for equipment purchases. That's linked, and we would link that to the phase-in of the rule. So if we don't have financing available, we can't go forward with these requirements. So here's how it works. If you put on the SmartWay package on your truck or trailer, and let's just say if you're going to do the upgrade that's for aerodynamics, that might cost you around $2,400 for a truck to retrofit it with the SmartWay package. And you might save in the order of $400 per month in fuel once you've done it. So it's a pretty quick payback in that case, about 6 months or so, less than a year certainly to pay it back. But it's a significant upfront capital cost, especially if you had a fleet of 10 trucks or 100 trucks. And so what's key here is to have a loan program where you can provide the upfront capital that can be paid back over time from the savings of the from the fuel savings. And we're fortunate in Oregon that we have an organization here called Cascade Sierra Solutions. It's a nonprofit organization set up to do just that. That's all they do, is provide financing for SmartWay programs. And there are several others around the country as well that do this, but Cascade Sierra Solutions is ours, and it's located in Coburg, and it's recognized as part of the EPA program. So what we will do if this section were approved is to establish a phase-in schedule that's tied to the availability of that financing. On line 24, we also recognize the difference between long-haul and short-haul trucks. The long-haul trucks are going to be typically traveling at highway speeds, and so the aerodynamic improvements are beneficial to them. A short-haul truck is typically going to be in traffic, not traveling quickly, and the aerodynamic add-ons actually just add weight to the vehicle and probably make their greenhouse gas emissions higher. So these have to be SMART requirements. The parts of SmartWay that you opt into really depends on the type of truck. And then on line 26, we also phase in starting with the largest fleets. So requirements would be for the larger fleets first, and they would phase in over a number of years to opt into the SmartWay program tied also with the availability of financing. So on this section, I'll note that there are big co-benefits. Ultimately, once the loans are paid back, ongoing net savings to truckers from fuel efficiency, reduction in toxic air pollution, and other of our important air quality goals. With the phase-in tied to financing, we've addressed the upfront cost issue, but that doesn't mean that the Trucking Association supports this provision. They're still opposed to this provision.
Hey, Andy, I'll ask you to move along here.
Okay.
I've got a couple of sections still to cover, and do so as quickly as possible.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll speed up.
Thanks.
Let's see. Moving on to the greenhouse gas related vehicle parts. This is our next measure on fuel efficiency, and this is the one that you have in front of you, a letter from the Special Equipment Manufacturers Association withdrawing their objection. So I'll be very brief on this section. Just say this is a big success story. You and all of your staff received many, many emails about this section. We were very responsive to the concerns, and we've revised the provisions completely. It's a complete change. What's happening now in the bill is that we've split the requirements into two provisions. One of them is section 3.5 on page 5, beginning on line 1, and that's an anti-tampering program. It's an existing program that is operated by the state of California. All of the equipment parts manufacturers get their parts certified through this California program to ensure that replacement parts are as high performing as original equipment parts. They're set up to do this. They have offices in Sacramento, and they don't want to have a second process in Oregon. And their request to us was that if a part is certified in California, it should be sellable in Oregon, and that's how this section works. And then on section 6, which is also on page 5, starting on line 6, this has to do with tires, and a similar story. You've got a letter in front of you from the Rubber Manufacturers Association withdrawing their concerns about the bill. And it's again tying our program to California. They've got an existing program to improve tire efficiency. The tire manufacturers told us they can't make a different tire for Oregon than they make for California. So once California's rules are in place, it will become a de facto standard for other states. This allows us to opt into that same standard to ensure that we don't get lower performing tires here in Oregon. So it's no additional requirement for the industry. Moving on to tire pressure check. This is in section 7 on page 5, beginning on line 6. And this provision also improves fuel economy by ensuring that tires are properly inflated.
Sorry, you're on line 21, I think.
Oh, sorry. Line 21.
Yep.
And and the requirement here is that when a vehicle is in the shop for another reason, either it's getting the oil change or it's getting a tune-up, that the mechanic will check the air and fill it up. And we had, from the beginning, support from the Northwest Automotive Trades Association about this provision. The concern we heard at the hearing was from the gasoline marketers, that if you're just coming to a gas station and getting gas, they don't have time to fill up your tires. They don't have a compressor available right there. They asked to have that exempted. And so that is exempted on page 5, line 25. If you're just pumping gas, this doesn't apply to you. It also, on line 27, we made it very clear that if you don't have a compressor, you don't have to buy a compressor. So this is just for those shops that already have a compressor and that have you back in the shop already and not just moving through and getting gas. So with that change, I don't know of any additional opposition to this provision. Moving on to idling, and this is the third of the three ways of reducing emissions from greenhouse gas emissions from transportation by running the engine for less hours. So the purpose here is to prevent unnecessary idling. Obviously, a lot of idling is necessary, and those were the concerns expressed at the hearing. We heard from propane distributors and tow truck operators and others that they idle for reasons. The idling operates electrical equipment like pumps and motors, mechanical equipment, hydraulic equipment. It operates lights, and those things are all necessary for their businesses. In addition, we heard from truckers that idling happens while they're in traffic. It happens when they're loading and unloading, and there are many places where idling can't be restricted. But there are some places where idling can be restricted, and in fact, the National Trucking Association and EPA have come out with a model rule about idling. So this is a rule supported by the National Trucking Association that would restrict idling, particularly overnight idling, where there are alternatives available. One other thing concern we heard was from the ports. This provision also would cover idling of ships at port, and we were informed by the ports that in Oregon, we don't have, typically we don't have long-term contracts where shippers are required to come back to our port, you know, week after week, month after month. They might just visit us once in a while, once a year or less. And in that kind of scenario, the port can't require them to put on electrical plug-in equipment, or they'll just go to a different port. So we added specific provisions to address that. So let me start with the amendments. So on page 6, line 4, we exempted idling that's needed for electrical and
Andy, why don't you move on to the next section? I think that we can read the ways in which you've created those kinds of parameters on the idling.
All right, I'm just about done. Sorry for taking so long. The last provision doesn't deal with transportation, so it's a little bit different. This deals with greenhouse gas containing products. And these products, as I mentioned in the hearing before...
And what page are you on?
This goes back to section 3 on page 3, line 27.
Bottom of page 3.
Okay. And so greenhouse gas-containing products. So these are the high global warming potential gases. They have hundreds or thousands of times the potency of carbon dioxide, and they can last in the atmosphere a long time. In many cases, there are no substitutes. They're things that we just have to use in products. But in some cases, there are substitutes. And where there are safe and effective substitutes, this section would allow us to require the manufacturers to use the other substitute products. There was a lot of concerns about the original language. It was unclear and not very specific. Food processors were concerned about how it would affect them because food products have carbon dioxide in them, and we hadn't specified just the high global warming potential gases, so it could have affected carbon dioxide. We had concerns about substitutes might not be commercially available. We had concerns about DEQ banning products and concerns about impacts on agriculture. Just really briefly, Mr. Chairman, the amendments ensure that we are only talking about greenhouse gases that are contained in consumer and commercial products. They are product content standards. They're not bans of products, so it would be a requirement for the manufacturer to meet a standard. They can only be imposed where substitutes are commercially available, meaning that they're available for you to buy, not just that they've been invented or are on the shop somewhere. That we will coordinate with other states, because obviously we don't want to have California set one standard and we set a different one and manufacturers having to meet multiple different standards. That this applies to the manufacturer and the importer, and that we can prevent noncompliance. We've specifically excluded fuel. Fuel is a product, but fuel is covered under the low carbon fuel standard. It doesn't need to be covered here. We've specifically exempted carbon dioxide, and so this only applies to the high potency gases, so it doesn't affect food processing. We have also specifically exempted incidental greenhouse gases that might be contained in the packaging. You could have a scenario where a product doesn't have greenhouse gases in it, but as it decomposes or as it over time it might generate some greenhouse gases. They might be caught in the packaging. That would be considered incidental and not and wouldn't apply. And we're only looking at the content of the product. We're not looking at how it was made. We're not looking at what happens to it later on, just what's in the can or in the appliance at the time. So we have significantly narrowed the focus on here. I need to just mention briefly that agricultural products are not affected. Pesticides are regulated by a federal law called FIFRA. I think it's the Fungicides, Insecticides, Rodenticide Act. And that preempts states, so there would be no regulation of pesticides. Ammonia fertilizers or urea fertilizers are not greenhouse gases. However, they could a byproduct could break down to nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas. However, that would be exempt because of this provision about incidental greenhouse gases. So this does not affect agriculture, or is not intended to affect agriculture. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll wrap up. I'm sorry I went so long, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about the amendments.
Thank you. And will you just say a word about Section 4, which appears to provide some additional parameters on the rulemaking authority in the
Correct. And, Mr. Chair, we had Section 4 is designed, it applies to all of the standards in the bill, so any rulemaking that's done, we have to evaluate carefully the safety and feasibility, make sure that we're achieving net greenhouse gas reductions and not just pushing greenhouse gases somewhere else, that it's cost effective, that we're looking at the net effects on public health. So if an alternate fuel creates groundwater problems or drinking water problems or other air pollution, we're going to take that into account. And the flexible implementation is pretty important, that this won't necessarily require a strict command and control type approach. We can allow flexible options. And I already mentioned that last provision about looking at what other states or other agencies are doing.
Great. Thank you very much for your work on this, Andy, and for your testimony. And I think it's an appropriate time to thank the many, many people who worked with you. Some of them got to the point where they were able to support the bill. Some did not. We'll hear from some of those folks today. But dozens of people who spent a lot of time in work groups and individually with you on this bill. So appreciate to all of them and certainly to you for coordinating that. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. And Mr. Ginsburg, thank you for walking through the bill. It's very helpful. On the section on products, section 3.3, bottom of page 3 that you were just discussing, I'm just a little confused on the exemption for incidental greenhouse gases contained in air in a product or within product packaging. Does that include or not include propellants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that does not include propellants. The propellants would be added intentionally, unless the propellant is a, and one of the reasons we exempted CO2 is that sometimes CO2 is used as a propellant, but it's a natural part of the product, and that became a confusion. So with CO2 exempted, but it does not include propellants that might be the high global warming potential gases.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
How much do you anticipate this field changing, either, you know, the technology or the market contexts and the or the science, and how do you imagine addressing those new awarenesses and changes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think the technology is going to change dramatically over time, and that's one of the reasons I don't want to get too specific on some of these provisions. For example, the greenhouse gas containing products, right now there are no safe or effective substitutes for many, many products, but over time I think they will be invented, and when they are, we should be able to add them to our list. With the low carbon fuel standard, we're shooting for a 10% reduction now. I think in the future, technology will advance. This bill won't allow us to go beyond that. We'll have to come back and ask for additional authority, but I think someday, maybe 5 or 10 years from here, we'll be talking about 20% or some other number that could be achieved. So I think technology will continue to advance, and it will, especially in this field where it's emerging and so important to the economy.
And as they change, and maybe that was included in everything you talked about, how do we imagine sort of addressing that? Is it Representative Boone's good comment? You'll make rules, come back here, say, hey, here's how things are going. Is it you'll go in a private room, with your best scientist buddy and write some stuff, 100 monkeys, with typewriters? What are our thoughts about how to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, some of the standards will have change built in, like the low carbon fuel standard. If there's a better alternate fuel that's available that becomes invented, we won't have to change the rule. We might have to identify what its carbon content is and what its carbon score is, but the basic rule stays the same, and it just gives the manufacturers another option. But for the greenhouse gas containing products, we would have to do another rulemaking each time we would add a new product, and that would follow the Administrative Procedures Act, and it would be, there'd be an advisory committee involving the manufacturers of that particular product to help advise us, but we would go through a rulemaking process, and if it were, it could be part of the report that Representative Boone talked about, or it could otherwise be reported back to the legislature as part of our performance measures that we do each session also.
One last one. Any other areas to give us confidence or disabuse us of confidence to where the future changes would indicate future intelligent decisions? Any other areas where, we sort of do that already, where we've either succeeded or failed in how we've done that?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, there are just many, many areas like that. I hardly know where to begin. As in air quality, 20 years ago, we didn't think about toxic air pollutants. We were worried about smog and carbon dioxide and particulate, and so the standards that were written at the time addressed those broad-scale pollutants. In the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, EPA started a focus specifically on individual chemical compounds for their toxicity, maybe their carcinogens or maybe their teratogens or other, you know, they have other toxic effects. And whole new, you know, programs had to be evolved in order to address those. So it's very routine in air quality that the world changes on us regularly. Recently, EPA has revised the fine particulate standard, so we have a whole nother round of trying to bring our air into compliance with that standard, and so we address it as we go.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly back to the truck section, Andy. You referenced that you'd seen some success with the SmartWay volunteer program, and I would note that this amendment says the commission may, but nonetheless, how do we know that a SmartWay program with the kind of financing that you had worked out won't work on a voluntary basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we have the program works spectacularly on a voluntary basis to as far as it goes, and there's a number of incentives that are in place. First you have those companies that want to do the right thing and want to be green. Those companies that are able to use it in their marketing. Those companies that have calculated the cost savings and have the upfront capital to make the investments are participating in SmartWay already. Some of the national companies are. You also have shippers that participate, and some shippers, Nike as an example, require their shipping companies to be SmartWay certified so that they're putting some, you know, it's still a voluntary program, but if you want to be a shipper for Nike, you better be in the SmartWay program. And so the program does work on a voluntary basis to a degree, but then that gets you so far, and then beyond that, there are lots of reasons why fleets won't opt into the program. Some of them are as simple as they're very, very busy, many of them small business people, and this doesn't rise to the top of their list. They may have trouble raising the capital on the front end, and so we need, if we want to get that next increment, and this is, as I mentioned, 20% of the transportation emissions is in the freight area. This doesn't address all of freight, but it's a significant chunk. Then we need some more organized program to help bring the rest of them into it. And the real concern about making sure we can do this without breaking the bank is why we put the provision tying it to financing. So it really puts the onus on us and on Cascade Sierra Solutions and others to come up with the financing. But if we can do it, and provide and make the financing available, we think it will work for them. And maybe more of them will come into it on a voluntary basis with that available.
Any other questions? Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And stick around. Now I'm going to do a very radical thing here and just go right down the list in order. We're planning to stay as late as 6 o'clock, but no later and not necessarily even that long. And I will ask Beth to run the timer here at 3 minutes per witness. I'll call you up in panels of three, beginning with Ramona Baker, Bill McCoy, and Ralph Groner, and do an even more radical thing and hand the gavel over to my vice chair while I step out of the room for a moment. Dangerous and radical.
Nothing like
that. Bill Barnhart, we'll
see to that. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME and the AFSCME Green Caucus. I was nearly knocked out when I entered this room, so some of the thought, I woke up in the arms of Rep. Gilliam, so if I sound a little more conservative than I normally am, that's what happened. Mr. Chair.
You just burned up a lot of time, I think.
Yes, I did. Mr. Chair. To AFSCME and AFSCME's Green Caucus, made up of 40 locals and growing throughout Oregon, climate change is, in fact, the most important environmental and health issue of our time and poses a serious threat to Oregon's economy and future way of life, rising temperatures, shrinking snowpack, changing water resources, and severe forest fires will all have serious implications for Oregon citizens and our farms and businesses. So most of these dollars we spend on energy and fuels leave the state's economy. We reduce energy consumption. By reducing energy consumption, we will keep dollars in Oregon to be used elsewhere in the economy. Increasing domestically produced clean fuels will help keep dollars in Oregon, creating Oregon businesses and jobs, and benefiting Oregon landowners. With regards to alternative fuels, House Bill 2186 does not specify, and that was alluded to by Andy, so I'll skip that. Increasing fuel efficiency in trucks by decreasing aerodynamic drag will put money in truckers' pockets. Increasing fuel efficiency of tires will put money in consumer pockets. The provisions of 2186 will reduce greenhouse gas emissions while increasing fuel efficiency. These measures and more are needed to reduce Oregon's contribution to this urgent global problem, and in so doing, we will benefit Oregon's economy and help improve the health and well-being of Oregonians now and in the future. And in addition, I'd like to add that there are several bills as a total package that complement this. House Bill 2626 on the building side, House Bill 3199 on the building side, House Bill 2671 retrofitting, thank you all for passing that nearly unanimously in the House, Metro's garbage trucks. We are looking at Senate Bill 80-3 and no cap and trade this session. I would suggest, and whether that's good or bad to you, the fact is this measure takes on increasing significance. And I read today's, I'll close with this, today's New York Times, front page of the New York Times, that the black carbon from diesel, front page of the New York Times today, is the health problem and the largest, second largest contributor from humans to global warming, along with coals and wood burning. So we are addressing a very serious issue that the scientists have agreed on, and my union and my environmental caucus wholeheartedly support your efforts, and we appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Perfect.
All righty. For the record, Ramona Baker with Environment Oregon. And first off, Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Environment Oregon is a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization, and we represent our more than 30,000 members, as well as the public interest in protecting our special Oregon places, promoting clean air and water, and most importantly to me, implementing sound climate policy. In fact, that is one of our priorities this legislative session, and HB 2186 is a practical approach to reducing our global warming pollution and placing us on a path to meet our state reduction goals. The bill, as we've already heard, and I would like to say thank you to Andy Ginsberg for that excellent overview, the bill will give EQC authority to consider and implement policies that best fit our state. In particular, many of these policies deal with the transportation sector, which does account for 40% of our global warming pollution in the state. So these strategies are absolutely essential. Specifically, Oregon's adoption of a low-carbon fuel standard would result in real reductions. Our studies show that this policy would reduce pollution by 2.1 million metric tons of CO2 by 2020 and 4.5 million metric tons of CO2 by 2030. This strategy is already being implemented in California and is being considered by many other states. The bill's timeline of reducing the carbon intensity of fuels 10% by 2020 is practical and achievable. In particular, we think it's very important that we do consider the life cycle emissions of these fuels, and we're glad to see that's made it into the bill. Finally, on some of the other measures, energy-efficient tires can cut fuel use by 1.5%. Aerodynamic improvements to trailers can cut fuel use by 5%, and upgrades to the cab can provide additional savings. Specifically, improvements in heavy-duty diesel truck aerodynamics could result in as much as 0.7 million metric tons of CO2 reduced by 2020 and 2.9 million metric tons of CO2 by 2030. So in closing, Environment Oregon strongly supports 2186 and urges you to pass it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ramona. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm not a politician, so I may not do this properly. But
you'll
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Bill McCoy. I represent M.O. Nelson & Sons Trucking in Eugene Springfield area. We've been there for almost 60 years. We started partnering with Weyerhaeuser early on, and we started with just a few trucks, and now we have over 105. We keep that many people in good living jobs and with benefits and stuff, and we don't want to lose them. It's been a hard year between the fuel costs last year and the winter and the economy. We, as a small business, we want to be environmentally friendly. We know it's a movement we can't fight. When we purchase new equipment, which we're all the time purchasing new equipment, it's always has the most, the newest, most innovative thing there is, because we know it. We might as well. These trucks last a long time. You don't buy them and then throw them away in 3 years like you do a car, especially a small business. We don't turn them over that fast. The things we do to save money. We like to save money. We know that money we save goes back into our business, and so there's no way we like to waste money. When our trucks go into the shop for a service, the men are trained to check the tire pressure in those tires. We want to know that they're up to the pressure's running what it should on them. A lot of this stuff would place additional monetary burdens on us that we don't need at this time. None of us here have something at home or on our backs maybe that didn't get here on a truck. So I don't think we want to see the costs of that go up. We, looking at this bill as it's proposed, you know, there's so much language in here that reminds me of a loan application with the percentage amount on the loan put in pencil, and it's going to be changed as needed. And these standards, where are they at so we can see them? The gentleman that spoke about this, you know, there's two of us down in Springfield that have over 250 employees. We didn't hear about this bill until today, this morning. So if he got in touch with somebody, he didn't get in touch with us. He talked about SmartWay. That $2,700 is the cheapest thing they've got to offer. Every one of those tires that you see on those trucks that they're actually would like us to go to Super Singles, you're talking over $1,000 per tire. And when there's no, right now there's no process for Michelin or anybody to recap those. So unlike our smaller tires, they're throwaway. So is that a waste or not? You've got that. You've also got a unit that they call a catalytic, it's basically a catalytic converter for a diesel truck. If you've any of you replaced those on your car, they're expensive. And that's another retrofit SmartWay has. So this $2,700, that's cheap. If he wanted it on all of our trucks, we'd be glad to do it, but it isn't. In this bill, they talk about...
if you could finish up, please.
Okay, he talks about long haul, short haul. ODOT considers long haul anything that travels within 100 miles. They don't have to carry a logbook. That should be short haul. They don't have to report their mileage. All I'm saying is that we need help with this economy right now. We don't need to burden it anymore. And there's nothing to gain from passing this or wasting you guys' time right now. Sure, we need to help the environment, but not at the cost of a bunch of jobs again right now. We, like I said, we've got 250 jobs in Springfield, and we know people in Roseburg that are in the same boat. You don't want to see those go down the drain.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Let me see if there are questions from the committee for this panel. Thank you. Let's move on and hear from Chris Hagerbomber, Jack Kinney, and Jenny Holmes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Chris Hagerbomber, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and it's a pleasure to speak with you today. Global warming is the defining issue of our time. It's one that we need to address, and we need to address soon. This is one of the bills that will help us do that. If we don't pass this bill and a few of the others that are in front of you, it'll be another 2 years before we begin to take action. So I want to say at the set, I won't go into all the details, but we do support everything that's in the bill, and I'll hone in on the low carbon fuel standard and the standards for motor vehicle tire replacement. So a low-carbon fuel standard, besides decreasing the global warming pollution emitted by transportation fuels, it would help grow Oregon's clean energy industry from electric vehicle manufacturing to cellulosic biofuels. It would discourage unclean energy investments, such as fuel from coal to liquids and oil produced from tar sands and oil shale. It would reduce our dependence on imported oil, keeping more money in the state. And it would reduce the sensitivity of Oregon's economy to oil price uncertainty and shocks resulting from refinery outages, cartel actions, or disruptions in world oil supply. In developing this low-carbon fuel standard, it needs to be developed in a transparent, timely, and a technically sound rulemaking process, which it will be. It needs to be fuel neutral. In other words, there needs to be an even playing ground for the fuels to qualify. It needs to follow a reasonable ramp-up to meet the 2020 goals that accounts for technology innovation. It needs to utilize market-based mechanisms to allow fuel providers to choose how they reduce emissions while responding to consumer demand. It needs to promote the development and introduction of advanced low-carbon intensity fuels that are not now commercially available. And it needs to contain regular milestone reviews to assure that the program is on track and achieving real carbon reductions. To the issue of the motor vehicle replacement tires, Ecos Consulting did a study when California was first looking at this, and they found actually at savings of at least 3% for using energy-efficient tires, and they estimated that a typical driver would save $87 to $260 on fuel costs by using these types of tires. And this was, well, at an incremental cost of 9 to 22 for two sets of energy-efficient tires. Obviously, the greater the cost of gasoline, the greater the savings. At the time this report was done, the average cost of gasoline was $1.53 per gallon. So we also feel that this bill embodies appropriate distinction between the legislative and regulatory functions of the state. It marries these broad goals of reducing greenhouse gases with the specifics of identifying means for meeting that goal. Our law mandates that the rulemaking process is open and participatory, and when that rulemaking happens, all of the stakeholders in this room and others will be there to participate to make sure that these rules meet the needs of our state and the needs of our stakeholders in that process. So we encourage your support of this bill, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Chris. Go ahead.
My name is Jack Kenny. I am the Vice President of Oregon Council of Vehicle Associations, a member of the Salem Auto Club Council, and a member of the Ben 8 Car Club, formed in this town in 1951. The only thing that I see on this amendment thing that really jumps out at me is the replacement tire thing. When we look down here at deep tread snow tires, what we used before we studded tires. Many people don't want to use the studded tires, and this is a good alternative. My thought on this is if they were put the same as studded tires on a November or off in April, well, at least for the people who need those living in the snow country. My brother happens to live at Idana, and they got 10 feet of snow right now, and it's still snowing on a daily basis this late in the year. So this is about the only thing that I see on this that really, really bothers us. The only other thing I would mention to the group is if we lose one job because of this bill, it's not good for the state where we're the highest unemployed in the nation right now. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. Tom Gallagher, Paul Cosgrove, John Ledger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing a couple of clients here. Because I get 3 minutes, I'm going to speak quickly and fairly specifically. On page 3, line 9 of the bill.
Sorry, Mr. Gallagher, who are you representing?
On this one, it is PGE. Thank you. Portland General Electric.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm having trouble hearing.
Yes, speak up, Tom.
It's these new hearing aids. I don't ever talk loud enough because I hear so much inside. On page 3, line 9 of the bill, where Andy talks about adding electricity to the fuels, I think the utilities would like to sit down with him and work on that language a little bit. I understand where he's trying to go, but the way the bill is drafted, I'm not sure that it doesn't overlap into other elements of electricity and carbon related with electricity. We're working in with the PUC and with Department of Transportation on electric vehicles and other activities, and just as a fuel part, I want to make sure that it is exclusively restricted to being electricity as a fuel used by inside of the auto or the fuels industry rather than on the electricity side. So with your permission, we will continue to talk to Andy on that. Generally, from the utility perspective, we have our own attempts to work on a plan for carbon reduction, which is not going very well. And the difference in this bill and the other bills for the transportation side is the huge level of detail that's going into this bill as opposed to going into the rulemaking and the planning process. And from the electricity side, we're watching that fairly closely. I'm not sure we're comfortable with that because we prefer on the electricity side to have those pieces done at the PUC. So switching quickly to another client, the Oregon Auto Dealers here, the bill is a combination of fairly large and big issues and then very small issues. And I want to point out why doing the legislation this way doesn't make sense to us. On page 5, line 21, where it talks about tire pressure, it exempts gas stations, I think, for a practical reason. Well, what about auto dealers that do auto repairs, which do have a pump someplace in the auto shop? But when cars come in to do that, we're not out generally checking their tires. My understanding is the way this would be policed is we would get a notice saying we should check tires. I'm just not so sure that that's, on a scale of 1 to 10, that's a very effective way, nor that it will produce any kind of a savings here. I only raise that to show the way the bill goes back from very general details to very specific details. The last thing I want to raise on behalf of all of my clients is the staffing and the cost problem of this bill. As I understand it, they're going to absorb the cost of this bill into the current staffing. 65% of this department are paid for by fees on permits. And there's a limited amount of money that goes into this. We participated last session in working very hard to get more general fund into this agency, which would go precisely for things like this. Unfortunately, this environmental climate, those were the dollars that were pulled that the agency had to give up first. I have no objection to that. I understand where you are fiscally. But it's very disturbing to the rest of us as permit holders and as the major funders of the agency to see a level of activity that, to be done right, is going to take up this much time, which doesn't have a funding source to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. You're going to hear a lot on the details of this bill. I'm going to touch on some general points. One is this bill had a lot of negotiations to it that I think are left completely unresolved, and there's still a lot of opposition to the bill. I want to talk briefly about something you did not hear, and that is you never heard that I heard. Maybe it was said, I missed it, from DEQ saying this is how much CO2 you're going to save with this bill. Never heard that. The bill probably has about 7 pieces that deal with greenhouse gas. I don't remember hearing saying this is going to reduce it this many tons, this is going to reduce it that many tons. So I don't know how you do develop policy when you don't get, we're not given those numbers. If this were a tax bill, you would go out and you would know if we do this, it's going to raise so much money from defenseless businesses that are trying to struggle every day. And you would know it's got this much coming from this part and that much coming from that part. You'd know that. You don't know that here at all. Now, one thing you might consider doing here is this, and I think Representative Boone kind of is going down this track. Instead of having this wide open, where you really can't make a policy decision because you have no idea what the reductions or costs will be here and giving it to the agency, supposing you said, okay, this stuff may be good. All of it may be good, maybe not. But why don't we have the agency do what they propose to do under this bill anyway and go through and analyze all these, see what the benefits are, see what the tonnage is, see what the benefit, what you get or not, and then bring it back to you, because they're going to do a report anyway, and you make the decision as to whether that's a worthwhile policy to pursue or not. And you will have the information that they're going to garner anyway, and instead of just punting it to the DEQ and having them make the decision, you'd be able to keep it in your hands and make the same kind of decision you do on taxes and other issues. And I would suggest that's something you might want to explore. Everything would get done just the same. And you'd have control of the policy and how it affects the citizens of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Koskoff representing Procter & Gamble Company, the American Forest Paper Association, and the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I also am going to say on a higher level, because you've heard a lot about the details, but I think that Andy's description of the process highlights from our perspective one of the major problems with this bill is that the basic policy decisions of how policy decisions will be made by, on these issues, are they going to be made at the legislative level or at the agency, have not yet been fully discussed, and they certainly weren't discussed in the work group meetings I was there. We were talking about the weeds. The bill is a little narrower, but from a perspective of most of the business community, not a lot better. I passed out as part of my testimony a list of folks who have reviewed the Dash Force since they came out in the last couple of days and expressed to you their concern that it still doesn't meet their needs and they still have concerns and oppose the bill. And that's because the basic issue of delegation to an agency for this kind of authority in our from our perspective is both a dangerous precedent and a very uncertain thing for us. Andy said it very clearly. In some cases, the EQC will require manufacturers to reformulate products. And the thought from people who make products that are sold in the international market, that five people sitting in Portland, Oregon, are going to try to reformulate their products is very difficult for them to swallow without some great concern. And that's one of the other things that I think I'd like to point out, and Mr. Ledger pointed on it, or actually Mr. Gallagher did, about the costs. This bill requires EQC and its DEQ staff to become experts on the economy, on energy markets, in some cases tire safety experts, the evaluators of the adequacy of financing available to the trucking industry, product engineers about what products and formulations of products work better and what the costs are, not to mention life cycle analysts and land use evaluators. This will cost a great deal of money, and we don't think this agency can take this project on. A more appropriate thing is for the agency to take some of these that appear to be the most beneficial from a cost-benefit analysis, study those and bring back to you specific proposals from which you can then, as the people's elected representatives, do that final evaluation. Is the benefit in CO2 reduction worth the cost and dislocation? In some cases, your answers will be yes, and in some cases, your answers will be no. But delegating it to EQC to make that decision, we think, is not the appropriate response. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Let's look for questions. Representative Smith.
I don't think defenseless businesses, they got you, man. I look at this list, and this is the list of the most prestigious, most experienced set of lobbyists. If you counted up the years of lobbying experience and understanding of this process, I've only been here, 14 weeks? And the average, is that my time? You average up the years or the pay or whatever here. Not defenseless, but I do appreciate the points, and I do appreciate the testimony. Hopefully we'll do the best we can.
I do have a question. Hang on just a sec, Representative Bernhard. Paul, you talked about five people in Portland making the decision. Is public notice required for rulemaking?
Mr. Chairman, of course. And the department, in fact, is very good historically in doing advisory committees, sometimes advisory committees that go on for months and months and months, which is a very expensive process and appropriate to get public input. It doesn't always work perfectly. But then the final decision is made by five people who do not actually hear anything other than a hearing officer's report in almost all cases.
But to be clear, stakeholder involvement is the norm when that advisory committee meets, when those rules are developed, yes, approved by the Environmental Quality Commission in the end. But typically, in your experience, are stakeholders closely a big part of that process?
Mr. Chairman, Yes, they are, to the extent they're at the table. And when you talk about worldwide industries, do they have the ability to monitor the activities and participate in advisory groups and meetings and rulemakings in every single state capital or city? The answer is effectively no, and so that concerns them. They have a better opportunity, if we're talking about a legislative process, to have input in their view. They prefer to have some of these issues, as we do, to be dealt with at a national level so that we don't have separate market forces in individual states, especially in small states like Oregon. We are a very small part of the national market, let alone the international market. We tend to want to control that from here, and that makes people nervous.
If I could just mention very quickly, the EQC is very good, and I think they're thoughtful. Our concern is not that we won't be there, or opposition won't be there, or there won't be a hearing officer report. Our concern is you won't be there. You're elected, and you won't be there.
That's very touching, but
he's just trying to help with the defense of the poor defenseless businesses, Mr. Chair.
But I mean, I want to follow up on this just a moment, because an alternative approach, and perhaps you would recommend this to us, is that we take the standards that this bill broadly sets, we work through the science as a committee or a subcommittee of this committee to evaluate the different fuels that are available at this time and how we get on a path towards 10% reduction, sticking just with that piece of it, that we'd have another committee working on greenhouse gas emitting products like the type are identified here, and trying to recommend or trying to decide which should be included and which should not, trying to adjust and respond to new science as it develops. That seems like a lot more capacity than a legislature that meets every 2 years, that's comprised of citizens who are not scientists, who don't have a background in this, who don't have the opportunity to meet with stakeholders in a long and a prolonged and deliberate kind of way, would be able to take on. So
I would agree 100%. That's why we would say the process and the bill, have DEQ do it. We're happy to have DEQ do it and bring it back to you. We wouldn't expect you to put in that kind of time. But the DEQ is proposing to do it in the bill, to look at all that stuff and do that analysis. They can do it. We think they should. We just think they should bring it back to you.
Representative Barnhart, did you have a...
After that conversation, I think I don't. Thank you.
Thank you. You too were touched.
Not exactly. Gilliam, stop touching Barnhart.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's have Bob Russell, Brian Doherty, and Mark Nelson, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Association, and first I would like to thank Andy Ginsberg for all the time that he's put into this effort. And anything that I say today is no reflection on Andy, his work, or the Department of Environmental Quality. I think what we have is sort of an honest difference of opinion here. In the interest of time, I'm going to focus on only one section of the bill, although I have interest in comments on other sections, but I'm not going to do that today because of the limitation of time. Last time I was here, I talked extensively about the broad delegation of authority to DEQ and how concerning that was to me because of the uncertainty that it creates. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about the low carbon fuel standard and point out to you how broad, in fact, this delegation is. If you look at page 2 and line 27, which is the beginnings of the low carbon fuel standard, it says that they can adopt standards, including but not limited to the following. So there's no limitation here on all the things that come after that. says that then on 29 it says a schedule to phase in implementation of the standards in a manner that reduces the average amount of greenhouse gas emissions per unit of fuel energy of the fuels by 10% by the year 2020. Is that 10% below 1990? Is that 10% below 2005? Or is that 10% below 2020? There is no baseline here. So you really don't know what the 10% is. And then it goes on to say standards for greenhouse gas emissions attributable to fuels, including but not limited to emissions from the production, storage, transportation, and combustion of the fuels and from changes in land use associated with the fuels. That's the life cycle piece. So you can imagine that biodiesel made with palm oil from Indonesia would have a different life cycle than biodiesel made with soybeans from Iowa. So how are you going to track that? Is each batch of fuel going to have a biography to tell, you know, where it was born and how it developed and all of those kinds of things before you can actually calculate the reduction amount? I mean, that's an incredible charge right there in that particular paragraph. But it also says that you can't, nobody can tell me how much 10% is, because it depends on what it's made from, how the land was used, how it was transported, and all the rest of those things. Then go down to paragraph H, starting on line 22. It says, coordination of Oregon's low-carbon fuel standards with those of other states, including but not limited to the schedule and the goal for the reduction of the average amount of greenhouse gas emissions per unit of fuel energy and default values for those reductions for the applicable fuels. If another state comes up with a different goal, then these rules allow DEQ to adopt that goal. So just with the low-carbon fuel standard, we don't have any idea what it means and what its impact is. It creates an incredible amount of uncertainty. From a business point of view, uncertainty equals risk. This bill is a huge risk.
And thank you very much.
Yes. And I would also suggest that we do some good work over the interim. For example, like we did on the transportation funding package and spent 2 years having lengthy discussions and then bringing things back to you for the decisions.
Thank you. Mr. Daugherty?
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, Brian Daugherty here representing the Western States Petroleum Association. I want to try and answer a very specific question of why we have a serious concern at this time with a low-carbon fuel standard. First of all, I want you to know, there is no low-carbon fuel standard anywhere in the United States. California is looking at implementing. They haven't triggered it yet. That was never voted on by their body. It was delegated by the governor to the CARB, California Air Resources Board, and they're trying to get there. No one's done this. We have spent 2 years and millions of dollars trying to understand what's the best path to get to 2020 goals. We have done nothing in Oregon on low-carbon fuel standards, and I think you're going down the road that you went down when you decided to make a pick of corn ethanol is going to be the answer, and you start picking a winner. You've already picked low-carbon fuel standards. That's one pathway to 2020. You have carbon taxes. You have cap and trade. You have many. We have testified we think cap and trade and a market mechanism is the way to go. This is very serious stuff that we're going down. You're not asking the Environmental Quality Commission to study something, look at it, and recommend to you which path to go. That is a policy decision. We had collaboratives. We've invited several of you down to these collaboratives we've had in Sacramento with university professors, with environmentalists, with state agency. We had several Oregon State Agency people down there trying to get to the right answer here. And a lot of this people are still working on. California's going there. They've had $39 million and 120 positions to look at this. We should watch what they're doing. But you're going to move to a deciding, once again, I'm going to pick what the winner is, and this must be the way we go to 2020. I don't think you have the information yet to make that decision. We have a Washington bill. I heard something about the Washington bill. The Washington bill came out late in the evening. It has no LCFS or cap and trade system. It has a study that says that the agencies will come back to the 2011 Washington legislature to discuss pathways. That's what I think you should do. This is, again, you're going down a direction, I think, with not enough apples in the barrel. The two handouts I gave you, one is an explanation on this. The other is the handout I gave you regarding the California, it's called the Preliminary Review of the CARB Staff Analysis of the Proposed Low Carbon Fuel Standard. It is an April 8th, 2009 report that just got released by Sierra Research. I'll give you just the summary. It says that in California that is going to cost people $3.7 billion per year in California in 2020. It'll have higher NOx, and you'll have NOx emission increases, and you'll have no detectable change in climate. Again, these are serious things that people ought to look at. This is the type of story. There are other reports that may say different. They outline what CARB believes may happen. But these are the studies that you don't have in front of you to decide which pathway to take. We are moving. As you know, we have a low carbon fuel, we have a low carbon fuel standard now. It's called E10, and you're about to adopt a B2. If you do that, you'll be one of only two states in the nation.
Please finish up.
You have only one of two states in the nation that has E10 B2. You will be a low carbon fuel state. That's what you're doing it for. So I think somebody should declare victory there. The last thing I can say, and I have to scrub it, this is the last phrase I can use. It has to go through the legal committees of WISPA to do this. And this sounds very much like Alan Greenspan, but what I'm allowed to say is that this will have significant upward pressure on costs. Sounds like Alan Greenspan, doesn't it? But it's as much as I can get out of representing a whole bunch of oil companies together as a trade associate. I thank you for your time today, and I hope you seriously consider voting no on this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers, Northwest Utilities, Northwest Food Processors, Metals Industry Council, and Les Schwab. I want to concur with the other witnesses. We believe this is a broad delegation of authority that really belongs with the legislature, and we would like to also concur in the recommendation that this is a study by DEQ. They bring back the information, bring it back, and you have seven different bills, in effect, in this dealing with seven different areas in this bill. We believe each one should be studied by the DEQ and brought back to you. We have particular concerns about page 3, lines 27 through line 30, where it says the Commission may adopt standards for greenhouse gas content and requirements to prevent venting, etc., of commercial products that contain greenhouse gases. It used to say commercial and consumer products. On page 4, it goes on to say the standards adopted under paragraph A of this subsection may apply to the manufacture, import, and use of commercial products. Again, they dropped the word consumer. Again, I don't know what the distinction is between commercial and consumer products. I would maintain without a definition they can be interpreted to be, in fact, the same. The other areas of concern in particular is Les Schwab and the section dealing with tires. In effect, and the objective, as stated by DEQ, is to adopt the California rule that has not even been ratified yet by that state, and to adopt that for Oregon. They have modified some of the language in here, but they have made it clear that that is their objective. Now, the rubber manufacturers of the United States have indicated that whatever California does, that's probably what they're going to do. I'm here to tell you that Les Schwab doesn't accept that. Les Schwab, as you know, is a premier tire distributor in retail distributor in Oregon, and they strongly object to these provisions. There is no true standard for rolling resistance, and the science and testing of that is being done on the federal level now, and it has not been determined, nor does DEQ have the capability to make that determination and determine that certain tires are in and certain tires are out. Again, we strongly object to that process. Again, finally, we don't believe that DEQ has the funds or the staff to manage these programs. There is no fiscal to this bill, which we find, quite honestly, incredible. This is going to, it's a huge undertaking by the agency, and we do believe that there should be a fiscal, and we should try to determine if you're going to go forward, which we hope you do not, what the costs are going to be. We believe it better to determine what the cost the DEQ would be to study these areas and to bring back seven very specific pieces of legislation to you based upon that study. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your testimony. Let me see if there are any questions. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doherty, or for anybody really, I'm just curious. So which route is a better route towards getting at climate change? Is it creating a market incentive to choose a particular method that best address climate change, or is it better to do study and then pick a route based on that study, or both?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, what our companies are trying to do is find out that exact question, and they are using the best talent from all sources to get together in a room to try and figure out which way to get there. It's not a conclusion. Right now, a majority of our companies believe a cap-and-trade mechanism, as broad as based, national, is much better, at least a large regional. You can't do it by state. But that market mechanism allows the flexibility to make this work at the least cost basis. And we're trying to develop that idea. I have many things I can send to you that are outlined of what the WCI process should be and what type of things it should be in terms of offsets and allowances and banking and borrowing and all that. That method is what we think here. We see this without any technology. We all know you cannot get to the 2020 numbers on current fuels. So you're saying, let's go and knock it down and hope we have something. And if we don't, then we'll say we'll off-ramp it after we've been trying to do this. That's a dangerous way to operate.
Well, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jordy also just was curious to hone in on a phrase that you or your attorneys used, significant upward pressure on costs. What else in your market creates a significant upward pressure on costs?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, I don't know what else I can say. It is constraining to say this. I think there are many things that cause increased pressure on costs. It can be from international to local. So there's in the fuel industry, a lot of things can cause it. It can be too much stock market play in the market. But there are many things. This is one that phrase can be used that they think it's very clear what happens, and we're not quantifying any more than that.
Mr. Chair Paul?
Yep.
So to clarify, that would be, for example, OPEC price manipulation, supply line disruptions, market forces, supply and demand, the general economy, the stock market, all of these things could potentially cause significant upward, significant upward pressure on cost?
Yes, they could.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, would you agree that a market mechanism is a superior way to choose a winner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, yes, I would. I believe that that the market left to themselves can reach the same conclusion that we're looking at in terms of cap and trade, the other various proposals have been made. If we're looking at cap and trade, I think we've made it clear in the past that at the minimum it should be approached on a national level and not on a regional, and certainly not at a state level.
So I'm loving the support for cap and trade, by the way, on the panel. That's fantastic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, you did not hear that from me.
The blue light is on, Mr. Nelson.
Yes.
Well, it's very heartening to hear, and I also support market mechanisms and cap and trade and associated other mechanisms to get to a solution. It would seem, though, that in the short run, in the absence, perhaps, of a cap and trade mechanism this session, that it might be useful to start that study process now and smooth that transition through implementation of measures towards potentially a federal system. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, that's not a totally inaccurate statement. What we have proposed as an alternative on the Senate side, as I think you're aware, is a very, very different process, and that is to work through the IRP process within the PUC that is set up to look at the future in terms of generation of power that's going to be needed into the future. We have suggested overlaying on that process carbon emission reduction planning, which we think is better done through that process. And you've seen that, I think, in the alternative proposal that we have put forward. We do not support the hard cap that has been proposed.
And Mr. Nelson, I appreciate the discussion here, but I apologize, Mr. Chair, for taking it to a different bill and a different topic. So I do want to limit the discussion on that. But I appreciate your elucidation of that. But the bill that you're describing to me does sound like another study. And so it does seem like this might be an effective way to start the process of actually getting some meaningful carbon reductions in during that time. Mr. Russell, I'm just curious to your comment about risk. Is there risk and cost associated with climate change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, there certainly would be risk and cost associated with climate change. What that is relatively unknown, as would be the impact of this bill. I think that's why several witnesses have suggested that we study a little bit more before we rush off and make choices. I mean, the proposal here is a very stringent regulatory program with a broad delegation of authority. There are other mechanisms or ways to achieve the same results. You heard a lot about voluntary programs that this is based after, but it's different. And the voluntary programs are just starting to come up and just starting to work. The clean diesel bill that we passed last session is just starting to come up and starting to work. And this is a regulatory layer on top of that. I don't think this is the best approach at this particular time because of the uncertainty that it creates for business and the risk that they see in this kind of an approach.
Any further questions from this side of the dais? Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Let's move on to Bill Hoyt, Tammy Denae, and Barbara Crest.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
And this may be something that will respond to something of what you're saying, but in the transition sometimes might be the best time for me to be least interruptive. And in saying this, and I say this because I know there are people who have yet to testify in the room, and I offer no disrespect. It really is the most impressive, most prestigious, most experienced set of lobbyists, I think, that we have seen on a bill yet who are rising in opposition to this bill. And any one of whom has more experience in this process, more collected wisdoms than I have. But I've heard a key argument, even a primary argument to some of my colleagues, about the proper level of delegation and fears about the overly broad delegation here. And I wanted to repeat a little, a smidgen of some testimony and also offer some that I have been looking up. Some examples of delegation. As testified today, examples within DEQ and EQC scope, it already has authority to regulate in areas of water, of air and water quality, not related to greenhouse gases. Also been looking into other areas. Public Utility Commission may adopt and amend reasonable and proper rules and regulations relevant to all statutes, et cetera, et cetera. Energy Facility Siting Council provides broad discretion to the Energy Facility Siting Council to regulate facilities and generate electricity in ORS 469-501. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, ORS 508-921, confers extensive authority to the Fish and Wildlife Commission to restrict Oregon ocean crab fisheries. Department of Consumer Business Services, House Bill 3126, group life and health insurance, use of policy forms, not just Oregon but other states. Not only California, where the raging liberal Governor Schwarzenegger delegated even broader powers with regard to greenhouse gases. Also Idaho and other areas within the ambit of their DEQ and every state with regard to different things outside the ambit of greenhouse gases. And, of course, the federal government, my favorite, the Sherman Antitrust and Clayton Act. First sentence, every contract combination in the form of trust or otherwise or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or within foreign nations is declared to be illegal. An act that totals, I believe it's 10 sentences. When my presidential hero, Republican Teddy Roosevelt, was using the Sherman and Clayton Acts, the efforts wasn't merely getting Congress, but to get the newly founded FTC in an area that's complex. Now let me get to my point. The areas generally relate to complex dynamic systems. Complex, where there is much detail
in technical and scientific areas. Dynamic, highly changing fields where the markets and science change quickly. Indeed, this statute delegates much less, given the specifics that have already been laid out, than many other areas that this state, other states, and this country does. It's complex and detailed, and it regards much science. So if we don't believe in global warming, that's a view. If we don't believe in emissions problems, that's a view. If we don't see the link to international danger, that's a view. If we think these problems will be solved naturally by the market without any government intervention, that is a view. If we think that Oregon shouldn't be a leader in this field because we think the economic cost to important industries will be greater than the economic benefit to other important industries, that's a view. If we think the U.S. shouldn't act until China acts because we are as much a tail as we are a dog in the global economy, that's a view. But when I hear as a primary argument that it is not the proper place to delegate authority from a legislative body to a regulatory body, that is a view that is harder to abide. Given this context, given the complexity, given the dynamism, good government principles would favor delegation here rather than disfavor them. So I hear from people who make that argument is not a fear of delegation, but a desire that nothing shall happen, or at least that nothing shall happen now, or at very least that nothing shall be required now. John Ledger from Associated Oregon Industries, who is, again, much more experienced in this process and more wisdom than I, is my teacher here. He explained to me and us on the record that people will advocate for the forum where they will get the best deal. Representative Jensen passed me a note on that day underlining how right and wise he was. I think that sounds right. Reasonable people can prioritize differently. Different people have different financial interests. I myself am in support of a number of things to soften the impacts of this, including Representative Boone's excellent suggestion. But let us not make this important policy decision based upon a false principle when what we're really saying and what we're really hearing is something different.
So you took pretty good advantage of the interim there?
Yeah. Thank and you. I may have to leave early, so I wanted to steal the time. We're working on another big problem as well.
Well, hard act to follow, but your job nevertheless.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the president-elect of the Oregon Cattlemen Association. I run a family ranch that's been in business in Oregon since 1852. We were awarded on the 14th of February, the one of 19 businesses in Oregon to have been 150 years. I check my cows a horseback on a bay mare, and I'm not too sure how much air pollution she creates as she goes along, but I know in the spring it's more than it is in the fall, and I know when she goes uphill it's greater than when she's on the flat. And I know that the act that I'm about to follow is very, very difficult. And so if you'll bear with me, we have some concerns about this bill from our membership in the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. One is that we have lots of folks who are in a position that may have to retrofit. And retrofitting we have estimates of $15,000 per vehicle to retrofit, not including tires, which could be, as was stated earlier, about $1,000. Some of our members have as many as 35 trucks and as few as one. These retrofittings can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars and greater. We aren't opposed to efforts to improve the environment. What we are opposed to is to put our members and the people that are working with our members at a very difficult position from an economic standpoint, making their small business efforts much more difficult. We think that this bill is a broad brush and takes a shotgun approach. We think that we aren't doing things that are specifically comprehensive to reduce greenhouse or carbon emissions, but simply hit and miss as far as getting to the real crux of the matter. And I agree that there are science based efforts that may be difficult to pin down. We think that mandating energy efficiency standards is difficult to require and excessive. We think that that regulation of manufacturing of commercial products for containing greenhouse gases is excessive. We think that this bill is actually multiple bills in one, and it leaves again a great deal of discretionary that we aren't sure how it will be responded to, good or bad. And I appreciate your time today, and I know we've got a lot of folks yet to testify, so I'll end my remarks.
I appreciate your time as well. Thank you for being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll note for the record that I'm not Barbara Crest, but I am the lobbyist for the Northwest Auto Trades Association. We had both signed up, but in the interest of time, elected for only one of us to provide testimony, and I had the short stick. So I will provide brief testimony on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association, who support the bill with the -4 amendments. We had several specific concerns about the original bill. Most of them you heard about because of our association with parts manufacturers and distributors. We were part of that cabal, if you will, and the department did a lot of work to alleviate those concerns. Some of them were simply a misuse of syntax in terms of how the parts manufacturing department used different phrases. We narrowed the scope of the bill significantly from the original. If I remember correctly, House Bill 2186, it was originally written to allow DEQ to adopt any rules to make the world a better place, and a lot of people thought that was a little broad, and they have significantly narrowed the scope of the bill. And the particular concerns we had in terms of requiring costs purchasing equipment among our members or not having certain tires available to consumers, or when those tires are going to be manufactured and who would be setting those standards. The department was able to draft amendments that alleviate our concerns, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that you have endured a great deal of testimony, and we are now approaching 2.5 hours, and I know you can only absorb what your backsides can endure, so I will keep my remarks very brief. I am Tammy Denny. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Our trade association is located and headquartered in Pendleton, Oregon, the heart of wheat country. And Mr. Ginsburg did make mention of his intent not to target agriculture, and we want to be sure that we commend him and the other members of his staff at DEQ for their effort not to impinge upon agriculture. We believe that that's their intent. We want you to understand for the record, however, that agriculture is a $5 billion industry in the state of Oregon, and we have a lot to be proud of in our ag production, producing more than 200 different crops in the state of Oregon across 17 million acres. That's tremendous, and those crops sequester carbon. That is what they do in their lifespan. They sequester carbon. We have a lot to be proud of in the state of Oregon. Of that 17 million acres, 1 million acres, year in and year out, is wheat production. And in its green form, it's sequestering carbon. We're very proud of that. We're not saying no to having a conversation about carbon sequestration, about greenhouse gas reduction. We are saying, however, that there are sometimes some unintended consequences to industries, and agriculture at times ends up being on the short end of that stick. Increased costs that come to the farm gate are borne by the farmers. They do not get to pass those costs along. Increased cost of transportation, because goods have to be transported to the farm and away from the farm, are borne by the farmer. That's a real consequence, and we have to be aware of that. There's a portion of this bill that speaks to port facilities. Four of the export facilities at the Port of Portland are grain-related facilities. We're competing in a global market. We need to be very aware and very careful about the choices we make and about how we are impinging, potentially, upon this industry. I know that's not the intent, but oftentimes it's the unintended consequences that do come back around and cause us to have to rethink and reconsider policies that we are attempting to create and address here inside of the legislative session. Our farmers are independent business persons, and the decisions they make about their land use are those decisions to make based on market forces. We want to continue that. I think every one of the members of this committee agree with that in concept. And we, for a number of years in the state of Oregon, have been very proud of our ag systems and our ag producers, and we don't want to do anything that harms them in the long run. Farmers do truck their product, so anything that affects the fuel efficiencies does affect our farmers. We want to be very clear and very careful about the issues that affect our producers and take those into consideration as you're moving this policy decision forward. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Denny. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. Tammy, and I forgot your name, Mr. Cattleman.
Bill.
Bill.
Yes.
If ag is out, does that make a difference to you? Because I believe I heard that agriculture is out. So I'm thinking, you know, it wouldn't cause you to, and plus you're not a truck on the highway, at the freeway in that sense with the big aerodynamic thing, and the tire issue isn't there, specialized tires. And the same, Tammy, you know, drivers and stuff. I just was wondering how you feel about that, because maybe these changes, which we just got yesterday,
yes,
have made a difference.
Do you want to go first, Bill?
No, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the question. One of the issues that we need to be very careful about understanding is that even though the intent is to exempt agriculture, when there are increased costs as they pertain to fuel or any kind of trucking system, those costs do aggregate back to the farm gate. It's not the intention, however, of this bill to incorporate agriculture, but we do unintentionally end up being swept into that net. Also, the other end of the industry, if we don't have the port system, if we don't have the export facilities that are servicing our industry, it won't do us any good to produce 1 million acres of wheat in the state of Oregon for export overseas, which about 80 to 90% of our grain is exported, grown for the purpose of export each year. And if the grain facilities are impacted adversely, which is not, we don't believe that's the entire intent of this bill. Again, it's the unintended consequence. So we're just asking that you be mindful of those unintended consequences.
I would echo that sentiment. We are not, in the production side, we're not totally away from the highway. I mean, our product is trucked just like any other product, and we have to buy tires. Even if I have a small four-wheel drive vehicle that I use on the ranch, I have to buy a tire for that. And if the tire standards are changed, it doesn't matter whether I buy it for a passenger car or for my farm vehicle. It's going to still increase my costs. And so, and fuel is a huge part of the processing that we do. We run balers and diesel, even though some of our diesel is not restricted as much as highway diesel is, we still have that extra. Last year when those diesel costs were high, our production costs for a ton of hay went from $180 to $275 or $80, so $100 a ton based strictly on fuel costs. And so our input costs and the market costs were down, so that our input costs were huge, and our market cost, our product costs actually went down. So the margin was extremely skinny, and that's not untrue of any part of agriculture today. So we have to be very careful about what our input cost is, because our margins are. I mean, I would say that our product has not increased in. Oregon cattle took over the top spot in Oregon agriculture in 2008, and we now have the point where our margins are so thin that if you look at inflation over the last 10 years, our costs have gone up at least 50%, and there has been a relatively stable point of the income to us. And so the bottom line has simply got severe in the last 3 or 4 years. And over 10 years, it's extremely severe. So we have the unintended consequences of a bill like this to us. It could be huge. Even though it wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, a quick follow-up. We've got to get you into a digester. You've got all those cows. They work great for power. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Fuller, just a quick question for you. I appreciate the work that you did with Andy to ensure that the language here was acceptable to your members. And I I wonder, would we be more likely, and we've heard a lot today about the problems in some people's view with this delegation of authority to an agency, would we be more likely to be successful for the folks that you represent if we were to pick specific parts of a car, specific products, and say, this is in, this is out, this is in, this is out? Would that make this a better bill, in your view, a biannual legislature that decided to try to make those sorts of judgments?
Mr. Chair, I introduced myself as not Barbara Crest, and I don't think I introduced myself for the record, but I am Darrell Fuller with the Northwest Auto Trades Association.
And I hope I didn't call you Barbara Crest.
No, you didn't. but you helped me recall that I didn't actually introduce myself. We haven't discussed that specific issue, so I can't give you an answer on behalf of the association. I can tell you generally, based on the discussions that we had on the first draft of the bill versus the Dash 4 amendments, what moved us from opposition to support on the bill was the specificity of the amendments. Originally, the parts manufacturers were concerned because the bill would allow rules on any part of a vehicle, and we've narrowed it down to tires, and we've narrowed it down to where we're looking at what other states are doing, and that Oregon's not going to go it alone. It's setting its own standards where we don't have the ability to move markets the way California does. So based on those conversations in getting us to where we're at now, my guess would be that our board and that our legislative committee would say, knowing exactly what we're talking about makes it easier for us to prepare to do that, as opposed to having broad strokes. Mm-hmm. And obviously that the specifics can be done in a legislative process or an administrative rule process, and that's a decision you have to make. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we can't determine what works for us or doesn't work unless we get down to the specifics.
Absolutely, and I think the process this bill sets up is one where those specifics take place in rules. Thank you very much. Let's hear from our last folks, I think it's just Evan Campbell and John Chandler. If anyone else is here to testify on either of the bills that we have posted, 2186, I haven't opened 3025. I only have names that also appeared on 2186. So Evan Manville, John Chandler, or anyone here to testify on the amendments to 2186? Mr. Chandler, go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to 2186-4 version thereof. I would like to address, if I might, the remarks made by Representative Smith. The passion for behind this bill and behind a variety of others this session is noted, obviously, and is not misplaced. These are incredibly important issues we're dealing with. But even with that passion, doing something oftentimes consists first of figuring out what it is one ought to do. My concern with this bill, and what you heard earlier about agency delegation and all that, no one is suggesting that this legislature ought to write a rule. That's not your job. Clearly, this issue is going to get delegated to an agency, whether it's DEQ or ODOT or the Climate Council or somebody else. Clearly, that's the way the system works. What isn't clear is what it is the agency is supposed to do. We haven't given them direction. We don't know what direction we're going. We don't want to recreate the ethanol Yahoo. Whoops, that wasn't it. This is too important an issue, and it's, what we do is too critical, I believe, to go down too many blind alleys. With that said, we stand, from a home builder's perspective, certainly supportive of doing something on climate change. I think we've demonstrated that in various bills this session. I hope we have. We intend to continue. Whether or not this bill gets us there is a separate conversation. I call your attention specifically, and I've talked about this with Mr. Ginsburg. I appreciate his openness and willingness to be harassed by a series of lobbyists. Page 3, Section 3A, and some terms that I don't know what this section does. It says we are going to regulate commercial products, undefined, which contain greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gas, in Mr. Ginsburg's initial testimony, referred to as high potency. That's not in the bill. I don't know what contains means. In my mind, if we're talking about cans of paint, cans of asphalt, cans of squirty cheese, we ought to say that, not whether or not this surface contains greenhouse gas, or house siding contains greenhouse gas, or tar paper, or. That level of specificity would be helpful just to reduce anxiety. I suggest it's also be helpful to give the agency a little more guidance about what direction you'd like them to take the rules. He has also stated that this isn't a life cycle. This section is not a life cycle analysis, and perhaps this is a matter of terminology and semantics, but when you talk about the use, disposal, manufacture, and import of a product, that seems to be fairly life cycle-ish in to my layman's ears. If that's not the intention, we ought to clarify what the intention is. Finally, in terms of clarifications, when it gives an exemption for products that meet standards, that making sure the products that meet the standards and requirements are available for purchase, I would like to have at least some consideration of price in there as well. Mr. Chairman, members, I don't know which one of you may use the phrase meaningful carbon reductions. I think the operative word there is meaningful. I can't tell you from this bill, even after talking to Mr. Ginsburg, after listening to many, many hearings, much testimony, what this bill will result in, or even likely result in, or maybe possibly result in terms of carbon reductions, meaningful or otherwise. I don't think anybody in this room will quarrel with the need for meaningful carbon reductions. What I think you're hearing is, how do we get there? How do we know when we've done it? What's the best process with the least disruption to Oregon's economy and Oregon citizens? Sometimes a study is a stall, and from body language I could tell some of you are thinking that. Sometimes it's the smartest thing you can do. I would ask that you think about that in that context of making sure that we know the direction we should go and give the agency that courtesy, if you will, to give them that guidance and not send them off with a set of vague generalities. Thank you. Glad to take questions.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Manville.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, Evan Manville for the record. I represent the Oregon Conservation Network, a coalition of 50 groups with over 100,000 members. Climate change is one of our 6 priorities this session. First, I want to applaud Mr. Chandler for calling for a bill to regulate squirting cheese, which would be a very interesting bill, Mr. Chandler, and an interesting relating clause. The road to climate change is paved by studying bills to death. Science on climate change is clear. We know climate change is worse than we thought. The costs are clear. Lord Stern had a comprehensive study finding it's going to cost 5 to 20% of our gross domestic product. University of Oregon came out with a study saying it could impact up to 10% of household income. We have the science to act. And it's time to act. In December, this bill was released. February 3rd, we had a hearing. March 26th, the dash four draft amendments before LC were distributed to the work group, and I applaud Mr. Ginsburg for doing that. I have not seen the opponents of this bill offer significant solutions to their concerns. Obviously, those that they offered were taken. Many of those that were offered that were reasonable were taken. I have not seen them figure out how to further constrain things. We have studied low-carbon fuels in this country for over 6 years. California started looking at this policy. California used to be, probably still is roughly, equal to the seventh largest nation in the world. They have spent huge amounts of resources, huge number of years studying this. They've got a 50-page draft rule. You know, we can have another health care bill that's not the way to approach things. States across the country have looked at the various strategies, the costs and benefits. These, as Mr. Ginsburg noted, are those that have co-benefits that make a lot of sense. They benefit our economy. They have pollution reductions. They just make common sense to move forward. A couple more points. I don't understand people who think this bill picks winners. If they want to bet me on electricity or biofuels or CNG or gas or diesel or biofuels or hydrogen as being the winning technology out of this market approach, I would be interested to see their odds. But it does not pick winners among those. It reduces the overall pollution from fuel by 10%. And that makes a lot of sense to use the market, because by 2020, things change a lot. Over 10 years, cell phones from 91 to 2001 went from 7.6 million to 120 million. Google was created, incorporated 10 years ago. Things change a lot. Using the market, having flexibility makes sense. Last point, I want to note that there's a talking point that there's no standard for rolling resistance for tires. And that's simply not true. Car manufacturers have used, since the 1980s, rolling resistance tests to get better EPA ratings. The Society of Automotive Engineers has a test procedure called J1269, measures the force required to roll a tire against a dynamometer, and there are 60% differences between the most efficient and least efficient tires. Similar tires often have 20 to 30% variation. There are lots of easy, cheap things we can do on climate change. We need to start moving forward. We need to do so now and not continue to study and let the delay take our economy and our environment down that road. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Evan. Mr. Chandler, I appreciate your acknowledgement that clearly the details of this kind of policy will need to get fleshed out in rulemaking. The specific parts that would be acceptable or would not is not probably an appropriate thing for the legislature to try to tackle. And you said that this bill isn't sort of clear enough about what the agency needs to do. Do you have it'd be great to get suggestions about how to clarify the language in your view. And I think you pointed at a couple of things, and they may be, I'd be interested in getting this in writing from you so we could look and see, is this in fact a place where it looks incredibly vague? That was the word you used. And maybe there's a way we can amend the bill to bring it up to those standards. What we haven't heard, I think, from you, and I think Evan was alluding to this, was those kinds of suggestions coming out in the work group process. Maybe they did. I wasn't at every one of those tables.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I wasn't part of the work group other than a couple of telephone calls. My specific issues are in that subsection 3 of Section 3. I can't speak to low carbon or low climate or low whatever it was, fuels. Somebody smarter than me can address that. With regard to that section, I misheard Mr. Ginsburg on one of the calls. He referred to squirty string. I thought he said squirty cheese, which I thought was even better. More use, especially in parts of the state or at frat houses. I'd be more than happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. When I look at this section, honestly, I don't know what products or DEQ intends to regulate. And I think they probably know, and I would talk to Mr. Ginsburg about that. Is it cans of things? Is it what? But the way it's worded is, I'll be more than happy to put that in writing to give some suggestions. That, however, begs the question of whether that's the best use, back to my other point about making sure we know what direction we're going to go, is that the best use of DEQ staff time to pursue the cans or objects or whatever it is we turn out to, that turns out to be the objective here? Is that the best use of their resources? That I can't speak to. I would simply raise the point. I can help clarify or perhaps delete things or what have you. I can't speak. That's where I think you folks come in with regard to your grant of power to the agency to make sure that they are spending their time, their resources wisely. I don't remember the fiscal on this. Remember, it seems like one of the hearings Mr. Ginsburg mentioned, 2 FTE, the second part of the biennium, which seems a little understaffed to me for this sort of work. Those same 2 FTE, the second part of the biennium, I would submit, could just as easily be put to work bringing back the list of things that should be done under this, at least with regard to this one section.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Just one quick thing on the record.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, just very quickly. I just want to be clear. My passion is less for this bill, and more for good governance, good decision making. And I think we share some of those, some of those passions, even if we disagree on how we're going to get there. And my own view is just that the charges of authority here are not significantly broader and maybe even narrower than many other areas. And so it does seem to me that we're very often having a conversation about process when we're actually disagreeing about substance. And I know we may have to agree to disagree on that, but just to be clear, it's less about this bill and more about how we're going to do things generally.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I absolutely agree with you. My concern with this bill, more than any of the other, and we have all sorts of substantive conversations going on the other carbon and climate-related bills going on elsewhere in this building. With regard to 2186 in specific, it looks to me like you're almost telling the agency, go bring us a rock. That's not enough specificity.
Go bring us
a rock. Go get us a rock. That's the old joke. You know, then they bring back, well, no, that's not the right rock. I really think we ought to tell them, with regard to fuel standards, with regard to the automotive side, the truck side, or with regard to Section 3 that I was harping on, more precision. From a good government standpoint, I think that's what you do. And then you tell them, now go do that. Bring us rocks of this sort, within this caliber, within along this creek bed, or whatever it might mean, not to stretch the metaphor too far. I agree with you, Representative Smith. The issue ought not be on this bill, but on the process.
And I would love to continue this conversation. I would point out, my final word on this would be that many of the folks who testified today who are directly affected, at least some of the folks who testified who are directly affected by the bill, did acknowledge the fact that over the work group process, those specific charges were clarified. And I think all of us could acknowledge that this bill has gone a long way in terms of honing in on what DEQ would intend to do with this kind of authority. And I think we heard that from a number of witnesses today. With that, I'm going to Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I want to make a comment before we leave today.
Please do.
I am absolutely committed to getting us through the transition, or doing my little part of getting us through the transition from a carbon fuel-based economy and a greenhouse gas-emitting economy to one that is long-term sustainable. There is no question in my mind whatsoever that this is absolutely essential work. It's going to be difficult. It's going to cost money. I believe that Bill, the farmer, the cattle raiser who I guess has left, will actually be far better off if we get this work done correctly, because his diesel costs are going to go through the roof in the next few years. I mean, there's no way that that isn't going to happen. I am unsettled about this bill, and the reason I'm unsettled about it is that the bill appears to me not to be a market-driven approach. It appears to be a command-and-control approach to a number of very important issues. That doesn't mean it doesn't have merit. It may, in fact, be exactly the way we ought to pursue this issue. But the concerns I have are not so much with what we're trying to accomplish or even the idea of a grant of authority to the commission. It is that we are trying to figure out what the approaches are that will work efficiently to actually get us through that transition that we're trying to do. Now, we're working on several different approaches. The Environment Committee last time and the Revenue Committee have been working on the Business Energy Tax Credit and the Revenue Energy Tax Credit, the idea of using a carrot to get people to do things that we think are good for to work us through this transition. There are a number of problems with that approach. The Revenue Committee spent a lot of time this session and also during the special session working on difficulties with that approach, because sometimes you give away carrots to people who would do the work without the carrot, and sometimes you give away too many carrots, and sometimes you're not putting them in the right places. So that's an issue. We probably ought to be looking at ways to actually raise the cost of doing things that need to change. That would be things like a carbon tax. Oregon can't do a carbon tax without a change in its constitution. Because of the way we have set up our constitutional restrictions around things like the highway fund, around things like the common school fund, restrictions on taxing fuels and other kinds of things. In another place, we're looking at a cap and trade approach to these things, which is market based in the sense that we're going to tell industry and others, this is how much you can of carbon or other things you can put out into the air. You figure out how to get it down to that. And we're going to charge you for the right to do that, or the right to do at least part of it, as an incentive to get you to get it down. This bill, as I see it, is a completely different approach. We're going to look at the department is going to look at the details within each area, and they're going to establish standards, and those standards presumably are going to be enforceable, and people are going to have to follow them. That looks like command and control to me. This may be the right approach. The others may be less valuable or more valuable. I don't know. We're venturing into an area where the government hasn't ventured very often before. The areas, the time places where it's been successful have been in the reduction of acid rain, for example, and that was essentially a cap-and-trade approach. There are lots of arguments about which is best and which will work best. I am not convinced that this bill or any of the bills that we're looking at or even the programs we have in place are the be-all and the end-all to these approaches. I believe the legislature must maintain control of this process and must maintain flexibility in its operation of the process and must have the authority to pull a plug on a process that isn't working or to insist that a process be changed so that it will work better in the future. So as I see this bill, and I have to say, is in the process of what I'm about to say, I am ecstatic that we were smart enough to include a sunset law provision in the Betsy and the Retsy law, which means that in a few years' time, we get a chance to completely redo that if we want to. If we want to. I'll support this Dash 4 amendment or this bill, but it's got to have, for me to do that, it's got to have an absolute binding requirement that the legislature readopt some law at some time in the future. Must happen, or I'm not there. It must have reporting requirements that are clear, that require a report from the agency about its progress, or I'm not there. I mean, it's as simple as that. This stuff is too important to let it go off into an executive department and not bring it back for a review. And if we pass this bill without those requirements, we have given away that authority forever, potentially. Maybe not, but potentially forever. I'm not willing to go there on this bill, knowing as little as I do about what the correct approach is to getting us to our long-term goals.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Barnhart. And we will be carrying over Representative Jensen.
Thank you.
I'm trying to get you to your meeting.
I know, and I'm going to be very brief. Be very brief because I want to get to a meeting. And we will have another time, another moment to talk about this particular bill. I'm going to make a restate something I've said several times before in this building, and that's to give back to you the story of Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in the waning years of his career, boarding a train, and as the conductor approached, start looking for his ticket. Couldn't find it, and the conductor coming up, recognizing who his distinguished rider was, said, "That's okay, Justice Holmes. You can simply give me your ticket when you find it." The justice looked at the conductor, said, "Young man, you don't understand. The question is not where is my ticket. The question is where are we going?" And I think if we look at the thousands of pages of issues that have been written about the environmental issues, they always talk about the protection of the environment, but they also, in the same sentence, talk about the cultural and the economic costs. And we are omitting many of those discussions. A couple of days ago, made a comment after session about the unemployment rate in the state of Oregon. We lead the nation. We're number one. Can we take a few minutes before we reach decisions like this and consider the economic cost of what we're doing? And that's all I'm going to say, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment, and it's certainly words to live by. Thank you. With that, we will carry over the work session on House Bill 2186 to April 21st. That would be a week from Tuesday. Yeah, carrying over to Tuesday, and I will close the work session on 2186 and close the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate it.